This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entik. Kuala Lumpur is often cited as a great place for expats to live in, but the same can't always be said for construction workers and domestic helpers. What makes a person an expat and another a migrant worker? I hope to get some answers from Dr. Amanda Kukowski von Koppenfels, a senior lecturer in migration and politics at the Brussels School of International Studies. She's joining me on the line from Brussels. Amanda, thank you for doing this.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be with you.
So your research focuses on Americans living abroad, in particular Europe. But can we start with your views on the difference between a migrant and an expat?
Absolutely. No, I'd be happy to do so. One of the things that I find so interesting about this distinction is that it really seems to have something to do with the country that people come from. Why is an American living in Brussels almost universally called an expat? But, for instance, someone from Argentina is almost consistently going to be called a migrant. And it seems to have nothing to do with their skill level or their income level, but just the country that they're from. And so that was the puzzle that I set out to try and untangle. Now, clearly, the term expatriate or expat has a very specific meaning within human resource, within business management, somebody who is sent overseas by a company for typically 1 to 5 years. They might have a special sort of expatriate package. They might have their housing paid for. They might have a school allowance for their children. And that is very clearly this very particular type of expatriate. But that term has become expanded out to everyone largely from the global north. And that's something that, as far as I can tell, for quite a lot of people who are from the global north, they're migrants. This expat term is a shorthand that doesn't really apply.
They don't use it on themselves.
Well, it's interesting. When I looked at my research, I asked people how they identified. I asked them if they identified as migrants, if they identified as expats. And people didn't actually like either one of those terms. My interviewees really preferred being called Americans living overseas. That was how they identified. They felt that both the term expat and the term migrant both had a lot of baggage, as one of my informants told me.
Do we know then how the term expatriates came to be used in how it's used today?
Well, legally, the term to expatriate actually means to give up your citizenship. And so expatriation was either to have your citizenship taken away from you by the government, or it was to voluntarily give it up. Then it grew into this term specifically used within business management, within human resource management. And then, as I said, I think from the research I've done, as far as I can tell, it's a shorthand that since many of the people who are on these short-term business assignments are from the global north, are quite wealthy, it became expanded out so that everybody who's American or Australian or New Zealand or German, they're all expats. And part of that, I think, has to do with a couple things. One is the assumption of why would somebody leave a country that is a classic immigration country? Why would somebody leave the United States? Well, clearly, they must only be doing it for temporary reasons. Therefore, they must be an expat. So I think that's one of the things that hangs together with this understanding of the term today.
Yeah, it's the assumption that the country that they're coming from is better than the country that they're headed towards.
And that's something that it's observers who are drawing that conclusion. Because when I asked people, why did you leave the United States? Quite a lot of people hadn't intended to leave permanently, but that was 25 years ago. And the number one reason for people leaving was to be with a partner.
So, as you mentioned, expats are almost never really used to describe people of color. At least in this part of the world, it's true. Do you find the term discriminatory?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the term expat does have a lot of baggage associated with it. Of course, one of the classic groups of expatriates were African Americans who were in Paris in the 1920s and 1930s, who were fleeing discrimination and racism in the United States and exclusion, and were finding a better life in Paris. And they were one of the groups of the initial expats. And that is something that still continues to affect migration patterns today. I've talked with African Americans who are living in Paris, living elsewhere, who are also seen as expats. So in terms of an individual's racial or ethnic background, that's not the link. The link seems to be one of the majority country. So what is the majority ethnic background of the country from which a person is coming? So Americans versus Ghanaians, for instance. So yes, I think it is a term that has strong racial overtones and ethnic overtones, yes.
And also, from America to Europe, in terms of power dynamics, I think a lot of people would think that they are largely operating on a roughly equal level. So migration mm-hmm. within the global north, is that less socially and culturally fraught?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, there is within Europe, there is, as you know, struggles with immigrant integration, with refugee arrivals, with all of these issues that are very much dominating the news. And when I speak to people about Americans, they say, but of course, you know, they're not problematic the way other migrants are. And that's one of the other things I looked at in my research was I said, well, what are the questions that are concerning host countries about migrants? You know, what is it? Let's pull this apart a little bit. Is it that people maintain customs? Well, that's one part of it. And my research shows that Americans maintain customs. Is it because they teach their children the traditions of their home country? Well, that's part of it. And Americans are certainly doing that as well. So in many ways, in a lot of the ways that we measure who is a migrant, Americans are behaving in exactly the same way. In fact, we all behave in the same way. These are human characteristics. These are human endeavors. This is not something that we can subdivide on the basis of country of origin. And then what it comes down to when we really look at it, that from a host country perspective, it comes down to a question of racially and socioeconomically based exclusion.
Can you talk a little bit more about your research? What did you want to find out about the experience of an American living abroad? What did you find interesting about that experience?
The thing that I found that really struck me the most was the biggest thing that American migrants have in common with all other migrants is that Americans, like Turks, like Moroccans, like Argentinians, like Malaysians, like everyone is identified by the host country on the basis of belonging to that country or to a migrant group first, and then identified as an individual second. And that's something where the stereotypes and the assumptions that go with a particular migrant group and or a particular country of origin are assigned to that individual without the individual having anything to do with it. Later, once perhaps somebody from the host country knows an individual, then the individual comes out. But everyone, all migrants, deal with the stereotypes and assumptions that are attached to their country of origin.
Is this comparable to maybe the expat experience in an Asian context?
That's something that is probably the next area of research. I think that that Europe and Asia seem to have very, very different experiences, and that's something I have not yet looked into in enough depth to be able to really, really go into. But I think certainly language is something that is very key. And being identifiable as a foreigner is something that certainly plays a role as well.
So some of the stereotypes that you mentioned, for an expat, it's usually someone who is highly skilled, highly educated, highly compensated in where they are posted to, and they're usually white. And in your research, is this true, at least in the European setting?
No, it's not, actually. Of my respondents, the majority were about 80% of my 1,000-person survey were white. But a considerable number earned far less money than I would have thought. And it turns out that most people, well, not most people, but the majority, the largest single profession is that of English teacher, is that many people are teaching English by the hour, are not earning a great deal, They might have come to the country they're living in either following a partner, or perhaps they had a one-year job, and now either the job has fallen through, or they might still be with the partner, or perhaps not. But the employment is considerably more tenuous than we had thought. So this is what I mentioned at the beginning: this idea that the expatriate is somebody who has been posted to a particular country. But for the vast majority of Americans who are living outside the United States, they have not been posted anywhere. They have moved. They have migrated. And they are, some of them have very highly compensated jobs. Others are living a bit more tenuous existence.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Amanda Klikowski von Koppenfels about the difference between a migrant and an expat. We'll talk more after this short break. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entik. My guest today is Dr. Amanda Klikowski von Koppenfels, a senior lecturer in migration and politics at the Brussels School of International Studies. We're talking today about the difference between a migrant and an expat. So, Amanda, we went through a little bit about how the cultural baggage that comes with the term expatriates and why it's used differently from compared to a migrant worker. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about how this status quo come to be, as in why does this hypocrisy continue to exist? Is it a symptom of capitalism?
One of my interviewees said, nobody likes the term expat, but we all use it anyway. And I think that's something that is very much the case, that the term migrant is very heavily politicized. And the continuing use of the terms migrant and expatriate to refer to two distinct groups, I think does continue to perpetuate this image that policymakers, that host populations have of a desirable versus an undesirable migrant. And so the continuing use of the term expat continues to place people from the global north in a desirable context. And that's something that I do think we need to move beyond. Is it related to capitalism? Yes and no. But I think more of it has to do with a global hierarchy of nation states and the way that we have located them in that hierarchy. A surgeon from Ghana working in a London hospital is always going to be called a migrant. An American teaching English by the hour in Paris is always going to be called an expat.
Language is very important, isn't it? What term would you rather all of us use if not this dichotomy of an expat or a migrant?
Well, I think that if we start using the term migrant for everyone who has moved, that is the UN definition of a migrant, is somebody who has left the country of birth or nationality and lives in another country. We are all migrants, and I think that if we can start using that term more broadly, then we can also contribute to the depoliticization of that term.
But it has a practical usefulness to having the term, the differentiation between an expat and a migrant worker in terms of policy making. What would you say to that?
Well, I mean, this is the thing, though, that the terms that host populations use about migrants coming from different countries does not adhere to skill level. Yes, absolutely. The majority of people coming from the global north are skilled, but they don't necessarily all work in highly remunerated jobs. People coming from poorer countries are not all universally unskilled. There are many very highly skilled people coming from poorer countries. And that, I think, is the distinction that we need to be looking at, is thinking about how do people contribute to an economy. And it's the skilled and the unskilled who contribute to economies. We need all of those workers, whether they are skilled or unskilled. That's something that whether we're talking about domestic work, whether we're talking about construction work or people who are in financial or academic professions, those are all people who, if the economy needs them, they are needed.
Is the evidence clear on the economic benefits that this migrant population, other than the expat, that they bring to the host country, is net positive?
Yes, but it depends on how you look at it. If you look at, for instance, the cost versus contribution of refugees to an economy, if you look at it over the first 6 months of their arrival in a country, of course, it's net negative. If you look at it over a longer period of time, it's net positive. This is the thing about migration and integration, is that policymakers like to think in terms that are linked to their election cycles. But immigrant integration doesn't work in election cycles. It works in generations. And that is and that remains one of the fundamental problems of any kind of policymaking related to immigration, is that the politicians think in election cycles and want to achieve unrealistic integration aims in short periods of time, when integration and the theories behind integration look at integration over several generations and not over a 2 or 4 or 5 or 6 year election cycle.
What about this assumption about immigrants are those who intend to stay over the long term while expats are professionals with a short-term contract?
Well, that was one of the questions that I asked my interviewees. I interviewed 115 people in London, Berlin, and Paris, as well as having a survey of about 900 people. And I asked people, are you a migrant? And people said, well, I guess I am, was one of the sort of responses that came out quite strongly. And I also asked people if they were likely to return to the United States. Far more than half said they were planning to stay. But that was something that kind of crept up on them. I call them accidental migrants because they hadn't left with the intention of staying. And this is something that we've seen again and again. The so-called guest workers who left Turkey and Southern Europe and moved to Northern Europe in the 1950s and 60s had initially intended to go for 2 or 3 years. And, of course, they're still there today. It's been said there's nothing as permanent as a temporary migrant. And that's something that's very much the case both for migrants in the United States, for migrants in Europe. And that was something that I found was the case as well for Americans. Again, the expat on the particular posted contract, that's somebody who, probably is going to stay for 2 or 3 years. But the vast majority of people from the Global North are not on those particular contracts. Instead, they are people who have moved for other reasons. They have either moved in search of work themselves, they have found a job, they have been with a partner, which is the single largest reason for people to move. And all of those are reasons where people do actually move far more permanently, far more people move permanently and end up staying permanently than we would tend to think.
Were you surprised by that finding, that the main reason, number one reason why Americans move abroad is to be with their partner?
Absolutely. The first time I did research was here in Brussels in 2005. And I did a small survey. I had about 100 respondents. And it came out that the number one reason for people to come to Brussels or come to Europe and move on to Brussels was to be with a partner. And my first thought was that my methodology was wrong, that I had to have a problem somehow that this couldn't be right. And I thought, all right, well, you know. And so then I continued with my research. And there have been other surveys that have come out as well. Overseas Vote Foundation has done one. And it is absolutely, being with a partner is the number one reason. That is something that I had no error in my methodology, that yes, this is the number one reason people move. And that did surprise me, yes. When I started the research, I had that same assumption that people were moving because of jobs. I was operating under that assumption, but my findings showed something else to be the case.
Do you think this is also the main reason non-American voluntary migrants uproot and leave?
Family reasons for migration is one of the very, very key reasons for migration. That certainly joining a partner, looking for work or taking up work that has been offered, and seeking refuge are the three main reasons for migration internationally. And yes, it's a close call whether labor migration or family migration is the number one reason internationally, completely globally, but family migration is incredibly important.
And I was wondering whether Americans see this concept of immigration differently, because one of the founding narrative of the U.S. is that it's a nation of immigrants. But an immigrant in that context is very different to how we call an immigrant today, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And that's when I asked people if they were migrants, that was actually their first reaction, was to say, well, no, because I didn't have to leave the United States. One woman I spoke to was Jewish, and her family had fled Russia, had fled pogroms, had fled anti-Semitic pogroms in Russia in the 1920s, and had sought refuge in the United States. And that was, she said, no, my grandparents were immigrants. I just moved. But what I found very interesting was that there was not this association of any kind of hierarchy. People did not say, well, I'm better than anyone else. They simply said, but I didn't have to move. And so, yes, so I think absolutely this idea of the American idea of immigration is something that continues to resonate both for American migrants themselves, but also for their families at home and for the government in the United States, which neither of which really conceive of this idea of American immigrants, of Americans who have migrated elsewhere. That's something that is another reason why I think, particularly for Americans, we continue with this idea of the expat, of somebody who's temporarily overseas, even if they have married somebody from the host country, even if they have dual citizenship, citizen children, even if their children are based in that country. There is still somehow this myth that at some point the Americans are going to return home, because everybody, so the myth goes, wants to move to the United States.
Yeah, I think this is the central misunderstanding on what shapes and colors the American public attitudes toward immigration policies, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think that is.
And then their understanding of immigration, maybe it's more in line with what we would call a refugee.
Mm-hmm. I think that is the case. It's a question of permanence, and it's a question of having had to move. You are forced to seek out something better, and you move intending for this to be a permanent move. But it's interesting that that of the sort of great waves of migration to the United States at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, a great deal of that migration actually ended up being temporary. One researcher has gone through and looked at data on Italian migrants, sort of one of our great waves of migration. And looking at census data, he found out that about 50% of those Italian migrants who came in the late 19th century ended up going back to Italy. And that is something that is at odds with our national myth of people coming to the United States and staying. So even that initial myth of the one-way migration to the United States, it's a little more nuanced than we tend to look at it as.
In your presentation about the difference between migrants and expatriates, which is available on YouTube, you say that only 3% of the world populations are living outside of their birth country. And you go on to say that we don't have a refugee or migration crisis, but an information crisis, which I really like that statement. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, this is something that I live in Europe, and to look at the news here in Europe today, you would think that every refugee in the world is coming to Europe. Well, 85% of the world's refugees are in Africa and the Middle East. There are 21 million refugees in the world, 65 million people who are forced migrants. And last year in Europe, there were 1.3 million asylum claims made. Lebanon had a population of 4 million before the Syrian war started. Now they have a population of 5 million. Their population has increased by 25%. That is a crisis. There are very specific points in the world that do have very large numbers of migrants and refugees, and that's something that is a measure of global solidarity. There needs to be more help given through UN agencies to help those countries that do have heavy numbers of migrants and refugees. But it's really, as I said, it is this question of communication, of having the context, of having the complete information, and not just the bits of information that pertain to that day's news. We need to look at the broader context. And that's something that I do in my teaching in the Masters in International Migration that I direct here in Brussels, is that we look at not just refugees, not just, for instance, human trafficking, not just labor migration, but that we look at this in this broader context so that we really understand that, yeah, actually migration, the big question is indeed, why do people migrate? Why do 97% of the world's population actually stay where they are from countries that have high migration outflows? Why is it that the rest are staying? Very often they're not able to migrate. The people who leave are the ones with the best chances. They're the ones with the language skills, perhaps with the money to be able to leave, with the networks. And so it's something that the information crisis is, I think, the one we need to really work on resolving.
And how do we do that?
I think we do that by reaching out as much as we can, by broadening our knowledge base, by educating as many people as we can through radio shows, through newspaper articles, that we try and reach out and we try and really do our best to make people understand that there is more going on than the small slice that one might see on any given day.
So if there is one misconception about migration that you wish to correct, what would that be?
Ooh, can't I have three?
Sure.
I think the biggest misconception is, well, let's put it this way, there's the two misconceptions that I would correct. One is the idea that migrants harm a country in some way. They don't. And that's something that again, part of that has to do with we need to know more about the people who are coming to a country. Psychologists talk about intergroup contact theory. The more you learn about people, the more you have contact with people, the fewer misconceptions there are. The other thing that I would point out is that I would like to correct is that migrants are human beings. They are people, just like people who do not migrate. That is something that very often, and this is something where this term migrant and expat and all of these different terminologies, that we somehow we tend to think of migrants as being either completely vulnerable, completely disempowered, that they are in some way a different group of people altogether. And that's not the case. Some of them have had horrible, horrible experiences, but they're still fundamentally, they're human beings, just like everybody else.
Thank you very much, Amanda.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.